you know, it might be a few minutes after three, because we see we go right up to three.
Good afternoon.
From my office.
This is the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. We are going to open the public hearing on House Bill 5069, the Oregon Department of Transportation. For the record, I'm Representative Greg Smith, Chair. We have Susie Jordan, our Legislative Fiscal Office, and we have Kay Bell as our committee assistant. Today we're going to continue to run through the 10% reduction list and also take a look at the performance measures, and Director Warner, I believe, is going to lead us in that effort. Really quick, though, before we proceed forward, I do want to recognize Chair Gilman from the House Transportation Committee and the members of that committee. Welcome. We're so glad that you could join us in this partnership as we try and merge policy and budget together. So, with that,
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Warner, Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation, and I'm going to attempt to start up where we left off, and I think I was on number 21, which I believe is on page, at least on my page, it's page 7 of 15.
Excuse me.
And on number 21 at the top of the page. And again, just to remind the committee, because I think there may have been some confusion, in terms of the priority of the reductions, the number one reduction, which was the for example, the debt service, is the last reduction we would recommend that you take. So I want to make that clear if I wasn't clear on that before. So as we work down the list, obviously those are the ones that we would say if you're going to take those funds, you would take those from the bottom up and move towards the top. I'm still seeing some puzzled looks. I want to make sure I've got that.
Okay, so the number one cut is the least likely to be cut. So actually, if we wanted to know what is the number one cut, we should be going from the back of the list to the front of the list.
That's correct.
I'm glad you clarified.
Yeah, okay, good. So I think there was some misunderstanding. Thank you. So I'm, again, on number 21, and we're still talking about reductions to our maintenance program. And again, to remind you, this exercise that we were asked to go through is essentially saying let's look at a 10% reduction in every one of the funding sources, type of funding sources that make up the department. So when you end up on the bottom line and the very last page, you'll be able to see the reductions of 10% in each one of the funding types that are submitted to the department. So again, this is number 21 is part of the maintenance program, and if we were to be required to take 10% from that program, essentially what we would be saying, for example, in this area, we'd be saying we would reduce or essentially eliminate most all of the sanding of roadways. So we'd rely on plowing, we'd rely on some limited de-icing, but again, there wouldn't be sanding. And you can imagine that is not something probably that the public would be very pleased with, because they really do expect that on our state highways at almost all times when the road conditions get bad, either icy or snowy. Number 22 is another program that we would say for the most part be essentially gone, is the elimination of the toll-free number that allows you to call up and get information on the condition of Oregon's highways and roads at any particular time. Thank you. Those of you driven up the freeway lately, notice the 511 now link that allows you to essentially get some real-time information on what's going on the roadways. We'd say that's something that should be eliminated. And that is part of the maintenance limitation. Number 23, low volume paving. This is an area where we would take some, again, reductions. And this is the monies that go towards those low volume roadways. I'm talking about roadways that have a 2,500 average daily traffic or less. So these are the minor state highways, but they're often very, very important to agricultural and the natural resource type of industries of the state of Oregon. And so we've done some very good things to keep those in shape, but this would mean that we are going to have to reduce the service on those, and probably some of these roads would degrade as a result of that. Moving on, number 24, the hazard elimination highway rail crossings. This is again would essentially say that we are going to defer 10% of the types of projects that we do to increase the safety at various intersections. So we'd be doing less new signalized crossing protections at the intersections between railroads and highways and roads around the state. and there would probably be some increase in deaths and injuries as a result of that. Obviously, we're continuing to make progress there and have most of the main ones taken care of, but this is an area we still think is something that needs to be addressed. I think you all read about those accidents when they do occur. On number 25 is where we're starting to get into our motor carrier transportation division. And as we said earlier, the last thing we'd want you to cut would be the safety programs. What we're suggesting here is if you were needed to take 10%, that we would be looking at field registration offices and essentially eliminating some of the service that is in those offices and probably the hours available to the motor carriers, and would essentially try to move them towards the trucker online and the e-commerce types of things. But there would clearly be some impact as a result of some of the truckers who are not available to take advantage of those services, who would be unable to comply with the rules and regulations in Oregon, so we'd have an enforcement issue as a part of that. Number 26 is the green light program, the Way in Motion program. After reading this, the manager, Mr. Delpani, and I chatted, and essentially this is something we are going to implement anyway. So I guess I would let you know that item number 26 is something that's there, and we are going to take that. We have decided with some efficiencies and work in the office, we'll be able to essentially eliminate the position and the support that goes along with that position and provide the same level of service. So this was a good call on his part, but I'm just letting you know that will not be in as part of our budget when we actually present that section to you. The next item, number 27, relates to our Transportation Safety Division. And every year we provide grants to cities, counties, and law enforcement agencies to again provide training and enforcement and safety. And for some reason we have the bottom part of, as noticed on the impact of the reduction, actually that's part of the previous green light management reduction. So this is the reduction to local governments and grants to local governments for transportation safety purposes. It has nothing to do with online trucking, as indicated in that final column. Are you with me on that?
Yeah. Okay. Really quick, though, we do have a question from Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Werner, I'm looking at number 29, uh-huh. and I'm wondering what effect on safety issues would removing $22.5 million from local governments have.
Mr. Chair and Representative Richardson, let me get to that. I'm on 27 right at the moment, so let me.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So okay. let me get to that one. I'll try to answer that as I get through it, if that's okay.
Okay.
On 28. This is something we talked about. The overall program is fairly important. This is in our public transit division, where we provide grants to cities, counties, and transit districts, and in some cases counties themselves and nonprofits, to provide transit service specifically for seniors and people with disabilities. And what you're seeing is a 10% reduction in that program, which would mean that, again, some people are not going to get served as well, or not going to be able to get the service they need to get to the doctor or the store as a result of those reductions. So now to 29, Representative Richardson. I think your question is, when you look at this, what we're suggesting as part of the highway construction limitation, that local governments would also need to have a share of their construction projects removed from the list to meet the 10% requirement. And these are clearly projects, just like ours were, that provide probably safety, mobility, and preservation of the system. So this $22 million, there will be safety impacts and projects that have safety benefits that will not get done and completed as a result of $22.9 million not going out from the department to the local governments for their specific projects. Did I answer your question?
Follow up. You did, but what I'm asking, I guess, is that supposing that this wasn't local government, but that your department had the responsibility to do these things that are covered by this $22.5 million, would it still be at this place on this list, or because it is safety-minded, it would have been lower on the list for cuts? And if so, then shouldn't we anticipate that the safety needs of the cities are a huge priority compared to some of the other things that we've already gone over?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, I think your question is valid. Is why is not this number right up there with the top few priorities that we have on the same for the same kind of things that we do?
Right.
I suspect when you look at the other things that we do, we try to say, what other things do we do that provide safety and public service? We could as just as easily put take that $22 million out of our one of our top priority programs and then put the Oregon Department of Transportation's projects back here. But if we were all in this together, which we are, it's a system, we have to look at the total needs of all of them. And this $22 million, in order to meet the 10%, would either have to come out of local government projects or state projects. And again, that would be up to you in terms of which ones you would want to see if you wanted to head that way. So I can't say that these are any more important safety projects than ours, but I could see why you would say, why isn't that $22 million up right with the others you have? And again, I don't think we looked at it that way as we were trying to get our share of the capital construction cuts made on our program, then looked at the other vital programs we had, then we went to the local government program. And so if I'm local government, I would be arguing that those should be in the same level of priority as the states. That was a long-winded answer.
Thank you for an honest answer.
Yeah.
Let me ask a question on this, and this is a 101-type question. How do you get a reduction if the Federal Highway Administration is reimbursing on local projects?
Mr. Chair, let me try to explain that. As I think we just talked a little bit before the meeting here, the monies we get from the federal government for projects that we do are all reimbursed. Essentially, we spend the money, we issue the check, then we bill the federal government, and usually within a week we get the reimbursement from the feds for that work. They give us a checkbook, essentially the amount of money that we can expend for their particular fiscal year, and then we draw against that account. So this is the money that they've essentially said, and we anticipate to get from the federal governments that we can reimburse them for on either our projects or local government projects. So my point was, when I was talking about what happens if we don't spend this money, the money that was allocated to the state of Oregon will be then taken away from the state of Oregon and divided amongst all the states who've spent all of their federal dollars, and they will take that money for us and use it on their projects.
So from a taxpayer perspective, the money's not necessarily going away. The money's going to go somewhere else.
The money would go away from the state of Oregon, Mr.
From
Chair.
The state of Oregon would, and go
yeah, that's right.
to other states.
Right. Just to put it in perspective, if you look at where we are in terms of the money if you look at the records and the analysis of what money we put into the Federal Highway Trust Fund versus what we get back out, we're very close to a 1-to-1 ratio. So we do very well compared to some other states, and so again we're very proud of expending those federal dollars on valuable projects for Oregon, so we can actually again get money from the other states that were unable to expend all of theirs. And so if we took these cuts, this is money that would be lost for the state of Oregon and for the transportation.
What steps would the state of Oregon need to take to increase the amount of money in that checkbook analogy that you have?
Well, what we do, Mr. Chair, is that we work very closely with our congressional delegation to essentially make sure that when the federal reauthorization bills, which establish the overall funding level of a federal highway trust fund for the next 6 years, are set at a level that is clearly above where it was in the past 6 years. And then we very carefully work with our delegation to make sure that the formulas, because they do just like you allocate monies to cities and counties and the state on a formula basis, they have a very elaborate formula whereby they divide the highway trust fund monies between the states. And what I've said is we've been very lucky because our delegation has been strong and we've been able to get about a 1-for-1 about that. Some other states are down in the 88 to 90 cent range, and so we'd like to see it continue. And so our job is to help our delegation and talk with some of the stakeholders that are out there also helping our delegation and Congress make decisions to keep that level up high and the formula advantageous to the state of Oregon.
Thank you. Representative Burley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Speaking about the federal transportation bill, what is the status of that as far as reauthorization?
Mr. Chair, Representative Burley, I think you're probably aware that the Transportation Equity Act of the 21st century, which was the last 6-year authorization from Congress, actually expired a little over a year and a half ago. And Congress has been trying to redo and establish a new 6-year authorization for that entire time as a result of elections, as a result of budget issues. They have been unable to do that. They are actually going to be taking up next month in Congress the bill which will set that funding level, hopefully, and it will have an act done before May 31st, because we've been operating on continuing resolutions and extensions of the current bill, current authorization act, up till this time, and those end on May 31st. And so right now it's a difference between what the administration would like, what the House would like, and what the Senate would like. And the good news is they're zeroing in on a dollar amount that's about $284 billion over the next 6 years for the entire United States.
Follow up?
Please.
Is that $284 billion more than the last 6 years?
Mr. Chair, Representative Burley, it is. I think the last 6 years, the total authorization level is about $218 billion.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Moving on, to item number 30. This is a program that we'd say that, you know, you really can't take 10% of it and have a viable program. You need to take all the program. Essentially, we would say under DMV, we're no longer going to regulate wreckers, regulate those folks who operate drive schools. Essentially, we'd eliminate that program, and either somebody else would have to do it, or essentially there wouldn't be any regulation for those businesses. On the number 31 is the one I would call your attention to in terms of registration for snowmobiles and campers and recreational vehicles. Again, we'd be saying that's an issue that it's a low priority for us in terms of safety or in terms of titling of vehicles for the purposes of again making sure that the ownership of the automobiles is assured. But this is a small program for us. You can see there's three people involved, 310,000 of total funds allocated to this. This is money that goes directly to the Oregon State Parks for their purposes. This is actually part of the Oregon Constitution, and there's $37 million of lost revenue that would not go to the Oregon State Parks if they were unable to essentially do that themselves. And so there's a real impact. You're talking about a small expenditure and a real impact to another part of the state.
Is there a database sharing mechanism between registration for snowmobiles and say state police or public safety for theft type issues?
Mr. Chair, of course there is. Actually, I believe the law enforcement folks have total access to all of our records. I can verify that, but I believe the answer is surely yes.
How does that coordination occur? If someone was to steal a snowmobile and when to register it, and the citizen reported it stolen, is there a mechanism that would signal or catch that someone who stole a snowmobile is trying to register one?
We should bring Lorna Youngs in here to talk about this, but let me tell you what I believe the answer is. In other words, if that vehicle had previously been titled and registered in the state of Oregon, then we have a title and a registration which has the vehicle identification numbers on it, just like a car.
Okay.
And so if somebody steals a vehicle and brings it in and wants to register it, they'd either have to essentially, and don't have that title, they would essentially have to say they've lost the title, and we would have been doing a search against those VIN numbers to make sure there's not a match with some vehicle that's been stolen. But I think we also have that list from the state police and the other enforcement agencies that would hopefully catch that before they're able to re-register it fraudulently.
What if someone came forward and said we don't have a VIN number?
Well, that's, and again, on this is where you need to get Lauren into the details. For example, if you're bringing a vehicle in from out of state, we need to check the vehicle identification numbers of the car. Now, whether we do that I know because I've had one done for a motorcycle. They've actually checked the vehicle identification for a motorcycle for me. Now, for a snowmobile, I can't answer that. So why don't you let me try to get, that'll be a question we've got recorded here, and we'll get you an answer back on that one tomorrow.
Thank you.
Okay.
Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, Director, I'm looking at the entire list that you've been going over, and I see that reduction in FTEs actually occur in less than half the entries. And so as I go through it, I'm confused. For instance, if I look at number, say, 36, analysis and research, well, that's labor-intensive. That's human beings. It's $2.5 million, and yet there's no reduction of any employees as a result of reducing $2.5 million of analysis and research. If I go up to, let's say, 23, it's low-volume paving. Over $6 million of work in paving is not going to get done because we just deleted $6 million from the budget, but there's no reduction in FTEs. I'm not sure what these people would be doing if they're not paving, if they would have been spending $6 million to do that. Can you explain why there wouldn't be a direct relationship in these kinds of things to reductions in FTEs?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Richardson. I think maybe you might have missed some of the discussion when I first started into this sheet. We made some assumptions. First off, for example, I would think you'd be more concerned, like if you look on the very first sheet where you have some of the major highway reduction programs, you're talking about, you know, major $140 million worth of reductions in our program, and you don't see any FTEs. What I said, for example, there is that there will be FTE impacts. We have not quantified those because what we've done, as an example, on the highway construction program, we've outsourced the big chunk of the new revenues. And what we're suggesting here is essentially we would take away that work from the private sector to retain the employees to do the work that they're currently doing. So there will be some impact, but if, for example, on those major $140 million, there will be very small FTE reductions because those are the people, as you pointed out earlier, are the people that are managing the consultants and the contracts getting the work out. So there will be impacts, but it's not going to be large numbers of employees. There are some others that we need to have FTE resources in. Most of those, for example, on number 21, reduced sanding, we know that there's about 2.5 FTEs that will no longer be necessary as a result of us eliminating that sanding. So what I committed to the committee to do is fill in those blanks for you on the FTE side as quickly as we could, and we'll get that also back to the committee very, very quickly.
Okay, thank you.
That help?
Well, I don't know why you wouldn't have been able to do it before these hearings occurred, if you can do them now, since we're talking about some items, you know, where there's two here or 18 here or one here, but others, it's blank, and so I'm not sure what information you're going to be getting in the future that wasn't available before.
We are actually, Mr. Chair and Representative Richardson, we are actually going to do the analysis to figure out if you eliminated this amount of work, for example, on those first priorities, what staff would we have to eliminate that's no longer needed to manage those projects? And it's not, you know, a specific one-to-one type thing like we do when we know what it takes to deliver it with our own folks. And in this case, it's much less. So we need to figure out, do we need to eliminate one person or do we have to eliminate 1.5? And really what that means is we are going to have to eliminate two. So we need to come back with some numbers that are really crisp for you in this area.
Please. I don't mean to get too pointed about it, but I understand what you're saying.
Okay.
You'll have to come back. But the information that was requested 2 months ago, and so wouldn't it have been more valuable for the committee to have had it now instead of having it come to us at some time in the future?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I agree with you.
It's a concern.
I agree with you. Can't argue there. So we could have done better and should have done better.
Please continue.
Moving on, I think I'm on item number 32 now. The hardship and probationary permits, this is, again, a low priority for us. Probably would be a very high priority for somebody who wants a hardship or a probationary license to be able to drive to the store or to their alcohol treatment programs. But we're suggesting that program would be gone. That would require some legislative change if you wanted to get to that.
Can you, Director Warner, can you share with us really quick and isn't there a relationship between this program and the arbitration program offered by the Employment Department? I understand there's an arbitration hearing office that is required within 30 days of a DUI suspension to provide that hearing.
There's a
relationship here, isn't there?
Mr. Chair, there is a relationship, and I'm not qualified to give you the answer on exactly how those two fit together, but you are correct. If we eliminated this, we'd probably be eliminating the need for another program in another department.
But
we can get you an answer for that, too.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think what you are referring to is the central hearing panel.
Correct.
At one point, several agencies had their own hearings officers handling those kinds of complaints or requests for arbitration. And a few biennia ago, we consolidated that all into one program over at the Employment Department. And so where this agency has a need for a review of of having a driver's license removed, it would go through the central hearings panel, and the Department of Transportation pays for that service. And so what Bruce Warner is talking about is if we reduce this, I'm not sure. It depends on what your statutory change
right.
would be, and if you include it in the statute that there be no remedy to it, they wouldn't have to go to the hearings officer then.
Let me share with you why I raised this issue. One of the things that was shared with this committee when the employment department was here is that those citizens who have had their license revoked, who are going before the central hearings panel, do not pay a fee for the arbitration that occurs. And the co-chairs have asked me and this committee to explore what would be the revenue generated and what would the necessary fee need to be to have those with the DUI who are looking to get their license mm-hmm. to pay for this.
Okay.
And so I think at some point we may need to have a discussion between the employment department and your folks to work through that scenario. That's the reason I raised the issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for that. I think that means you'll probably want to know the average annual number of those kind of requests that go through that
right.
then. So we'll make sure we've got those numbers handy when the question comes up. Item number 33 has to do with our Transportation Safety Division. Again, this is where we provide monies and funds to the schools to help cover the costs of driver education training. And the revenues that we get are earmarked for that purpose. So without a law change, the money could not be used elsewhere. But again, that if you were looking at 10% reduction, we'd probably be saying you ought to be looking at that as one of the things to reduce. I think Representative Richardson, you had a big question about the transportation program development programs relating to statewide and regional studies, where we're essentially saying we're going to reduce the funding for grants to cities for the most part to hire consultants to do planning work in their particular jurisdictions. So, for example, on that one, there is no FTEs because those would essentially be monies passed through dollars going to the cities where they would be retaining the services of a consultant to do planning work for them.
What would the effect be on this with our land use planning?
Mr. Chair, I don't know whether there'd be any difference in terms of land use planning. There would be a difference in terms of cities being able to comply with the land use planning in terms of having acknowledged and adopted transportation system plans that meet the requirements of the transportation planning rule. So the intent is to try to help local governments comply with the local land use laws. That's one of the main purposes of this. But I know this wouldn't have any change on the land use laws themselves.
Right. No, I wasn't implying that. I'm just curious what Director Shetterly would care to, what his response would be on this type of reduction.
Mr. Chair, I wouldn't attempt to speak for him, but I would say that he probably would not like to see the resources go away from cities and counties to do this very valuable work. As I think I told you before, one of the most important things we can do, if we have acknowledged transportation system plans, that means that those projects identified on that list have already cleared the land use hurdles, and we can move forward much more quickly into implementation. They don't have to go back and do land use decisions at the local level, at the local government level, which can then delay projects if there's appeals for a number of years. So there's some real benefits to having this work done. Moving on, item number 35. Again, this is also part of that same program. This is really some of the other things that we've been providing to local government to do things other than transportation system planning, but allowing them to look at providing them resources to do changes to their development code related to transportation, but usually around development of a particular opportunity that they have for jobs. Also to deal with particular problem areas that may occur as a result of somebody wishing to bring a large plant or employment into their particular city. It allows us to work with them to get their development codes put together, and I'm sure DLCD and the director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development would really think that this was one that should not be eliminated from our program. Number 36, again, part of our planning staff's work, again, is analysis and research. And this is, again, where we would essentially eliminate state-funded research programs, reduce them dramatically, about a 32% reduction, and would rely just on other states and our, and what we have remaining to do development of new products and services that would help us do our work better in the future. In terms of 37, this is one of those ones I think I told you before where we have a considerable amount of general fund, and you see that we have $902,000 is the reduction of 10% of the monies that we spend for the provision of two round-trip Amtrak trains in the I-5 corridor, along with the supporting thruway bus service that linking communities to that I-5 service. And frankly, I don't know that it may be even possible to say to Amtrak, we're going to reduce down the amount of money we're going to give you by $900,000, so please stop running for 2 months out of the 2 years. I'm not sure that will work, but again, this is the what we would say that you need to bring out of this program to hit the 10% reduction.
Mr. Chair, can I ask?
Please, Representative Buck.
And maybe you haven't looked at this yet. Are there months that are significantly lower in ridership than other parts of the year? I've just always assumed it's fairly consistent throughout the biennium, but I may be wrong.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hutt, I can't answer that one for you, but we can sure have that's an easy question because we do track the ridership by month, and I think we can provide that to you tomorrow.
Sure, we have a follow-up, Representative Richardson.
You know, on the same issue, if your home food budget needs to be cut 10%, you don't quit eating for 2 months.
Right.
You just would cut back a little bit, and so I would assume that if there's 9 trains a day, they would go to 8 or 7, but they probably wouldn't cancel for a couple of months out of the year. But who knows?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richards, I think the question is, if we're paying for 2 trains, will they let us pay for 1.8 train, or would they say you need to pay for 1 train and we'll just drop the other, you know, 9 months of service and we'll live with 1 train, which would obviously reduce the amount of money necessary dramatically. And that's a dialogue we've not yet had with Amtrak is all I'm alerting the committee to.
I want to digress really quickly back to the statewide and regional studies.
Yes.
Next week, we're going to have the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department in the C-Picture. And the question I would have is, in your studies, are there economic development components where you address their initiatives and their vision in line with what your department and local government vision is? How do those two merge together, their efforts and yours?
Mr. Chair, that's a very good question, and I don't believe that I can answer that today either. All I know is we do coordinate our work with them, but in terms of a coordinated and integrated approach to looking at these from the standpoint of economic development being a priority, I think all of these usually are giving to communities with the intent of positioning their transportation systems to the point where they're able to support the economic development and jobs that they want in those areas in the future. So I think all of it is directly related, but I think I would need to do a little more research on that and really understand that and also advise my counterpart, Marty Brandley, that may be getting some questions on that. So I'll make sure that we're both answering the question the same way.
And where I'm going with that is I would like to know that within those plans, so long as there's no statutory limitation or federal restrictions, that there's an economic development component in there, so that as communities are putting together their plan dealing with their vision, that those who are reading those plans can see the economic development component that helps feed the plan. Anyway, thank you.
Number 38 is related to the rail-related capital projects, and as I think I mentioned to you when we were going through our priorities, we do receive a certain amount of dollars, about $15 million from the Federal Rail Administration that is passed through to the railroads for capital improvements and improvements, physical improvements to their rail infrastructure. And we would say you need to reduce 10% of that, and obviously this is dollars that again will probably then also, like the highway dollars, be reallocated to other states. Mass transit vehicle replacement, item number 39, this is a program that was increased dramatically in the 2003-2005 biennium. In fact, actually, the main portions of the funds were made available for that. This is a program where we provide monies, again, to those transit providers in the forms of grants to buy replacement vehicles. This is where the identification card revenues go in the program. And you can see that we're looking at cutting 10% of that budget, which will reduce the amount of a number of replacement vehicles. And this is everything from a small van to, a 30-passenger bus. And these are both rural and urban in nature.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Burton.
Could I ask you a little bit more specific about that list? Do you have the list that you could provide to me that shows what replacements have been made?
Mr. Chair and Senator Berger, you bet. We just went through a process probably about 8 months ago where we allocated all of those monies to the various providers, and I'd be glad to show you the list of the people who are the recipients of those funds and the types of vehicles that they're purchasing with those monies.
Thank you very much.
Moving on. The next item, number 40, marketing and travel alternatives. This is a brand new program that was initiated at the request of the legislature last session, where we are essentially allocating monies to do the long-term, education and marketing of alternatives to driving in the heavily congested urban areas of the state of Oregon. It's the attempt to essentially do transportation demand management. When you hear the TDM acronym, that's what that means. This money is to pay for, the anti-smoking campaign for, driving, to encourage folks to understand the alternatives to driving, such as walking, bicycling, using mass transit. And the intent is to create a long-term program, and we're saying if we're getting down to the 10% level, this is probably a program that we would essentially need to eliminate in total, which I'm sure the people who wanted this last session would say that's probably not where they want to go in terms of the reductions. But that, you can see, is $1.5 million that we were planning on spending on that particular program. There was a question on number 41, I think the chair had, about vehicle identification number inspections. And as I said, if we were looking at cuts to meet the 10% requirement, we would say we ought to, instead of trying to just reduce down this program, this is a program we should probably eliminate, which means DMV would no longer inspect vehicle identification numbers, and it would require legislation from you to be able to do that. It also would probably not be good for vehicles who come to Oregon without that kind of check, because that's where we have an opportunity to check for stolen vehicles and check the titles of those vehicles to make sure they're not salvaged or have been totaled in other states.
I'd like to, not today, but between now and the time we wrap up with your department, have someone from the DMV come in and talk about that issue a little bit.
About vehicle identification?
Yeah, I'm struggling with how a thief who takes one of those utilizes that asset. Short of having it for personal use or selling it to a buddy for cash, what are they going to do with it, and how do we, how do we ensure that, those aren't being sold in some way that we could be wrapping our arms around it, especially knowing what we have in terms of the problem with meth and other issues. And so I'd just like to pursue that a little bit.
Mr. Chair, we'll be glad to do that and talk about the brands that are put on vehicles to protect the consumer so they know what that the history of that vehicle is when they
perfect.
Purchase it.
Thank you.
42, again, one which some people enjoy. Often people whose cars don't go through DMV go to the DMV and get a DEQ. When they don't make it through the air quality emissions test, you go to DMV and get a trip permit while you are able to get your car repaired to be able to pass the test. What we're suggesting is we would no longer issue trip permits. The legislature limited the numbers that we could issue the last session, but we would say just completely eliminate that program. going on for DMV. DMV would say if you're going to cut their budget in the amount that we're talking about, that essentially we would say that for the field offices, essentially they no longer accept vehicle registration only transactions, and they would essentially be done through the mail and issued through our central headquarters here in Salem. And then finally on this page, maybe it's not the same on yours, but 44 is the commercial driver's license test.
Director Warner, are you talking about the vehicle registrations that new car dealers do at the field office?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, no. I'm talking about if you as an owner of a vehicle need to have your registration redone, you would have to essentially mail it in and have it sent to you from Salem rather than being able to go into your local Coos Bay office and have that service provided.
Is that service available? No, wouldn't it be available online because you need a sticker?
Yes, that's correct. It depends, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. It depends if you need a DEQ certificate or not, but I believe we actually have the ability, correct me if I'm wrong here, staff, to do online re-up of normal vehicle registrations that don't involve DEQ.
And then the stickers put in the mail and mailed out.
Yes, yes. 44, this is one where we're saying, again, that where we now provide driver's license test drives for commercial drivers. We're talking about the folks who drive trucks and commercial vehicles. We would essentially say we're going to get out of that business and rely on the private sector to provide that. And right now, the private sector does provide that service, and we'd be saying let's get out of it entirely and leave that to the private sector. And you can see there is 11 folks that are eliminated in that program. The next item is also a DMV item, which most of you have probably gone through these debates if you were in the legislature before this time, dealing with special plates. And you know we have a few special plates, and we have a number of group special plates, and everybody always wants another special plate for their particular item. What we would be saying is that, you know, that's a lot of work to do, and we ought to get out of the trying to issue, again, all these different types of plates because it can be very expensive and time-consuming. But by eliminating that, you've also eliminated about $8.6 million of revenue for state parks, Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, and so on. So I just want to let you know that there's ramifications of that. DMV, again, item 46, the motorcycle drive test. We would say, again, that we would get out of that business and would, again, rely on third-party vendors, private sector, to provide that service. And we do allow that service now, but we would be having others do that for us. Related to that, again, is the titling of ATVs, snowmobiles, and campers. And again, this is, again, the issue we talked about in terms of registration and titling in terms of the major impacts to state parks. In this case, what we're saying is you'd really not have a title then issued by the state of Oregon for those types of vehicles. So the people who loan money on those would have to find some other way to protect their interest in those vehicles or have their own system.
Director Warner, really quick on back on special plates.
Yes.
I see the different categories that are listed as recipients of the revenue.
Mm-hmm.
Would it be possible, and maybe this is for us to do, but to get a breakdown of how that $8.6 million is distributed among these categories? And let me tell the committee what I'm looking at. I'm looking at the Youth Litter Patrol Fund, which must be, is that summer work?
If that is.
Okay. And then I'm looking at State Parks and Recreation, which is very needy, but also tied to lottery. And perhaps we ought to look at those different sources and determine where the best use of that money would go.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that's a very good point. And we can do that, and we will do that for you. We have the breakdown right now. And I think what this all gets down to is a conversation you and I had about trying to understand within our budget which of these revenues and things that we're dealing with are completely fungible and can be used for any purposes versus which are completely limited and required by either federal law or the Constitution to be spent elsewhere. And so I think to get to your questions and Representative Richardson's concerns, we're going to try to provide you some breakdown of those numbers. We'll let you understand where those revenues are, where they go, and what ones could be used for other purposes, like these are funding the youth.
Thank you.
I think I'm down on special programs, and this gets back down to a large cut in the bicycle pedestrian programs and obviously our efforts to retrofit culverts on state highways. And this, in order to do this, as I told you before, 1% of the Highway Trust Fund must be spent every year on bike and pedestrian facilities. So if we wanted to implement this change, we would have to essentially require, we would be required to do changes in the legislation to allow this money to be used elsewhere. But it could be used on other highways and roads if it wasn't tied to the bikes and pedestrian facilities. And then DMV has also suggested that if we were looking at the 10% cuts, we would eliminate posting of drug test results on commercial driver's licenses, and this is was done at the request of the trucking industry a few years ago, and put into law that essentially we need to track that for them, and this allows them to understand when one of their potential new employees or existing employees has a drug, a positive test, either for alcohol and a DUI or a bad test for urinalysis. But essentially, we would no longer have a way, a set place for folks to check that. And so I would suspect the trucking industry would not like that at all. All right. And I think I'm on the last one here, number 50, the last big one, which is the Board of Maritime Pilots. And they're, again, a small budget, and all we're saying, if they were taking their requisite share of it, there would be $20,000, and would, obviously, they believe, hamper the board's ability to undertake any new activities, implement new policies. They noted the affirmative action and outreach program that I think the legislature required that they do last session, so they would probably be telling you with this reduction they couldn't do that. I think Senator Johnson, would probably like to engage a little bit more in that conversation. Item 51 on the capital improvements, we would obviously say some of the first things you would eliminate would be some of the maintenance and improvements to our maintenance facilities, and so this is the 10% of that. Probably if you're really going to take some money, you'd probably want to take more, but again, this is where you're just deferring that maintenance to a later date. Capital construction, essentially we're saying, again, take the money from that, because we will not build or rebuild one of the maintenance facilities. And then finally, we're saying if you need to, take 10% then of the Connect Oregon program, and that's the $10.5 million, because when you add the processing costs and so on to issue the bonds, that's where the $105 million is the total, as opposed to $100 million, which will be in the bill.
That's a little presumptuous, isn't it?
It is. I should say that if approved by the legislature, and you wanted to meet this criteria, you would only give us 90% of what we had asked for.
Thank you. Any questions? All righty. I think we're going to performance measures now.
Correct, Mr. Chair. Mike Marsh to go through the performance measures, and if the members could open up their books. And I'm going to ask you to take a look at a couple different pages before we actually go through the measures in detail. The first page is page number 96. If you go to the tab, which says key performance measures, and then go to the last page, and that behind that tab, it's page 96. And you don't actually have to look. If you don't wish to, I can just talk you through. It's headed by review of request to modify performance measures final.
Is everyone there?
Last page in our key performance measures.
Next to the last tab.
We're getting there.
Okay.
Next to the last tab. Go next to the last tab and then there.
It's a tab called Key Performance Measures, which is the second one in the book, and it's the last page of that group, and it's called page 96.
What's his next last tab?
Different
book.
Yeah. Somebody help Burley.
Yeah. I'm okay.
He's okay.
My chairman's got the wrong book.
No, he's got the right book.
He's got the DCB.
Perhaps Representative Gilman's book has cut by 10%.
It's okay.
It had to be somewhere.
I brought the wrong book yesterday. I have.
Thanks, Susan.
Oh, my.
Mr. Chair, if everybody has it, I'd be happy to get copies if some had the 10% reduction taken from their page. If we look at this page, it comes from the Progress Board and is the evaluation of the Department of Transportation's performance measures. And I just wanted to begin there since I understand that you're interested in hearing about those evaluations. Bottom line is the summary at the top of the page there says, after the mission statement, that ODOT has 22 key performance measures and ODOT meets all the criteria for performance measurement from the Progress Board. It goes down through then talks about each one of the major areas which they evaluate and talks about meeting the criteria for each one of the elements of things such as gauging progress appropriately, having a few number of measures, not too many, setting targets, and including customer satisfaction measures. So I just want to make sure you have that background. If there aren't any questions on the Progress Board's brief summary of the situation, I'd like to move just ahead a little bit of page 96 to page 33 and 34 in the same area. Just move ahead to pages 33 and 34, unless there were questions. And this is headed by a request to modify 2003-2005 agency performance measures, which went to the Progress Board. And what it shows here are five measures that from the legislatively approved measures from the 03 session, we requested approval to make adjustments. The first one there, if you look, it says number one on the left side under request. Yeah, it talks about bike lanes and sidewalks. We want to get away from a measurement that talks about percent of urban state highway miles with bike lanes and be able to do something that focuses on what facilities need bike lanes. We didn't feel like it was really answering the question of the public nor of the legislature to say how many have bike lanes when there may be a lot of facilities that don't need them.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you. Mr. Marsh, I'm a little confused about the word need. That may differ in the eye of the beholder. How will you make an objective decision about what defines need?
Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, you're right on target. What we have done is suggested that rather than going through the word need, what we want to do is move to system condition. So the adjustment you see here is what we presented to them initially, but after working with them and talking about different options, we're asking to change it to, in essence, the percent fair or better or the system condition of bicycle and pedestrian facilities. So we will be doing a system asset condition evaluation rather than talking about miles needed or numbers with bike lanes. We're going to be talking about system condition evaluation. So that's what we're moving to, and we're asking to adjust, in essence, what you see here so we can do an inventory of the current facilities and come back with something that talks about system condition. Does that answer your question, Senator Johnson?
It does. I guess what I'm still wrestling with is listening to your description of doing your system assessment. And I know as soon as I say this, I'm going to have everybody who wears spandex calling me talking about bikes, and I beg that not to happen. But how much money does it cost to do this system evaluation for bike lanes?
Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, what we're doing is trying to I don't have a direct answer about how much it'll cost. We're not going to go through and do a huge inventory of everything that's out there. What we're going to do is try to make sure that we've identified where the money has gone and what we see coming in the plan for areas that have to be addressed. So it's not going to be, we have two people in the shop. We're just going to do a very basic analysis and do this over the next couple of months.
Okay, thanks.
Yesterday there was discussion, and perhaps it was Senator Johnson who raised the issue about a bike and pedestrian plan. Are those plans, or is that plan coordinated with other improvement plans that you have? So a community's going to have Main Street renovated, and that's part of, say, the STIP. Does that STIP project match up with
okay,
a bike and pedestrian plan?
Mr. Chair, let me try to answer that. First off, I would point to you in the answers we gave you as a response to questions. I think the last question that relates to the question that Senator Johnson asked about that particular thing in terms of how we coordinate. Make it clear that state law requires us when we do an improvement project
bike lanes, pedestrian facilities must be part of that facility unless we determine because of traffic volumes or extraordinary costs that we can't do it. So anytime we're doing a project, we need to look at that and make a determination, yes or no. And I mean, that's the law. That's what we have to go by. And obviously that 1% of monies helps defray the cost of those types of portions of those improvements. Senator Johnson's question was, when you're out doing maintenance and preservation type work, are you looking at those opportunities? And the simple answer is yes. And again, we try to make those determinations on a case-by-case basis. And sometimes, like on the coast of Oregon, there's a number of areas where there's no shoulder, but the shoulder is where they want to widen it. The problem is we're doing fills into wetlands when we're trying to add those bike lanes. And so there's some often constraints that don't allow us to do that. But the answer is we are looking at that and coordinating on everything we do, and we're required to do that under the current statutes that you have in place.
Thank you. Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, looking at this, number one, I see the concern that Senator Johnson has in that, as it stands now, like it or not, at least it's something that's measurable. What is the percent that we can deal with? If you change it, it now becomes subjective, because it says it'll be changed to 2% of state highways that need bicycle pedestrian lanes. Well, determining need is now a subjective standard that could change depending on who's making that determination from biennium to biennium. This will be very difficult to track how you're meeting that performance objective or even determining when you've met it. And so that the word need makes it subjective. Can you give us some idea of what we're trying to accomplish here? And then maybe the performance objective could be worded in a way that focuses on the performance that's desired, you know, the outcome.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, maybe I wasn't clear. On this first one, we made a request to the Progress Board. We had a discussion about doing it on need. We agreed that need would not be the best way to do it, and we're going to a system condition measure, which says what is the condition of the asset. Like the pavements, it's poor, very poor, fair, better would be an indication of what the condition of the pavement is. This will give us a condition measure of what the condition of our assets are. So this will be a measurement that focuses on system condition. We will also look at an element of the, like you talk about, a bridge and what it's able to deal with in terms of traffic and weight and conditions where you have to post because of weight. We're going to look at issues about what the demand might be for bicycling in a certain area. But the primary focus is going to be system condition rather than need and rather than the number with bike lanes.
Oh, so essentially you're changing the focus of the original measure.
Yes.
Because it looks to me like the original measure was to move toward a goal of having more availability of bike and pedestrian lanes. And now the focus would be we may never expand it, but we're going to focus on the condition of what we've got. That would be the
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, yes, but I don't want to lose track of the fact of what Bruce has said. We have a requirement to do approximately 1% with each project. We have, and we'll talk later on in the performance measurement discussion about what we've done on bike in terms of our expenditures, but the fact is that we're wanting to make sure that we do get those monies appropriately spent on bike and pedestrian facilities. I do want to make sure that that's clear, that we aren't pulling back from making sure we meet that statutory requirement. The measurement, however, is making sure that we're measuring something about the condition of our system.
Just one follow-up. It sounds to me like that that may or may not be important. I mean, I don't know if it is a desirable performance measure to determine how you're doing, which is also subjective, on bike and pedestrian lanes when you're essentially, I guess it, that's only appropriate in my mind if that was needed and we didn't have it and what was sought after before is no longer needed, because essentially that's what we're doing. We're canceling one and going to another, which may or may not be a performance measure that is really needed. That's your expertise to determine.
Mr. Chair and Representative Richardson, I just give my perspective or maybe our perspective about that. When you're talking about percent that have bike lanes, it does not necessarily tell you anything about whether that's really good or bad. It's just
numbers.
It's just numbers. What we're trying to do here is make sure it's communicated the condition of the system, because people who ride bikes and walk want to have a system that they can also use appropriately. And there have been a lot of complaints about the condition of the system and making sure that they can use it readily, that we don't have trees causing problems with the ability to use the facility, that it's a usable place without high risk to the person using them. And so we want to make sure that we're answering that question, and that's what this would get at, just the same as pavements would do.
Okay. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When was the last time that we had a constitutional review of all of the non-road activities that are being performed by ODOT?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, that was done in year 2000 from the Department of Justice. And if you're asking for that, I'd be glad to get that for you.
Follow up?
Yeah, we'd like to have a copy of that if we could for all the members. Follow up.
Did we get a clean bill of health?
You want it since you were here?
Sure. First envelope. Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, the review showed 63 areas of concern, and we came back to the, I believe it was 2001 session, with a pretty major bill to make those adjustments, and the legislature pretty much did the adjustments that needed to be done in order to bring us in within the constitutional requirements. There were a couple areas that are still pending. We have at least two court cases still pending to deal with how that will finally be defined about whether it's constitutional or not. But we are operating within that guidance from the Attorney General, but we'd be happy to bring in that review.
Would you like to follow up?
Were expenditures for bike lanes included in that questionable list that had to be remedied?
Mr. Chair and Senator Morris, I believe bike lanes were one of the questions. I'll look back here.
Chair Smith, members of the committee, Doug Tindall, Deputy Director for the Department of Transportation. Chair Smith, Senator Morris, bike lanes were determined to be a constitutional use of the state highway funds. The rationale for that is that when the constitutional restriction was enacted in 1980 on the ballot, the voters' pamphlet specifically said that bike lanes would be that bicycle and pedestrian facilities would be an allowable use of the highway fund. That was actually in the voters' pamphlet in 1980. Based on that, the Attorney General said then it was a constitutional use because that was clearly understood by the voters when they voted the constitutional restriction.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, we'll move on to the second one then in that list, unless there are further questions. Okay. Which is moving from a fish passage measure that talks about number of river miles of habitat opened up to a measure that talks about number of culverts that block fish. And that gives a more tangible indication of what the problem is rather than talking about river miles out there, and also reduces the amount of judgment about what's going to happen in terms of the impact of the blockage. So it's moving to that distinct number of ODOT culverts that block fish. There are no questions on that one. The other three are not changing the actual measure, but are changing the methodology for calculating the measure. Just a brief overview on those. Vehicle miles traveled. The old calculation was done in the Portland area only. The new measure allows us to go to all the metropolitan planning organization areas, which would be Portland, Salem, Eugene, Corvallis, Medford, and Bend, are all included now, so we can count that as areas that we're measuring the VMT travel, as well as taking out some areas of the calculation that is now available to calculate dealing with through traffic and not including them in a measure that's mainly trying to target on commuting. The next one is travel delay, and similarly there, some work in the methodology to take out some elements that don't relate directly or to at least have the information available. And that relates to the involvement of accidents or incidents in delay and use of operational measures like where we do have traffic metering or signal progressions. That kind of information will be part of the data as it comes in. And the last one is construction job impact. And what we've done there is move from just really focusing on construction expenditures to a recognition that we're doing a lot of work now. We have a lot of engineering firms that are working with us doing that design work. We need to account for that as part of the jobs, as well as right-of-way and local program expenditures, so we're including all those elements in the jobs impacted in this measure. If there are no questions, I'll move to going through the measures in a little more detail. And if we could go to the front of that key measures section. And the first page shows a simple table of contents. The second page is what I'll begin addressing.
Not the last tab. Final tab.
No. Tab number two, key performance measures, and the second page. Everybody's tracking there.
All right.
It's headed by key performance measures and ODOT performance measures, outcomes, and benchmarks. And I did want to mention, just by way of overview, that as we go through these benchmarks, there's a strong tie between our mission statement and what our measures are. The mission statement is to provide a safe, efficient transportation system that supports economic opportunity and livable communities for Oregonians. Therefore, we're trying to make sure that connection is clear between transportation and markets and getting people to work and recreation.
I need to chew on you guys a little bit here.
Mr. Chair.
How do you obtain your mission of providing a safe, efficient transportation system that supports economic opportunity if economic development isn't with you hand in hand in all of your planning?
Mr. Chair, I wouldn't say that economic development is not with us in planning. I think the point is that we have worked with them in different elements of our program. So whether you're talking about the civil rights program and working with the small business development centers, or whether you're talking about working on getting jobs for people in rural areas of the state, we do make contacts with those folks. Now,
let me chew on you a little bit here.
Okay.
If I asked you to bring an expert up here to tell me about the STIP and tell me about all the projects that are going to be conducted, I bet you could. If I bring Marty Brantley up here and say, who's your person that's going to tell me about the projects in the STIP, I'm willing to bet that they're not going to have someone. And so what I want to know is how do we get transportation to be integrated with economic development to make sure we're all moving in the same direction on the same path? And maybe this committee has a different perspective than me, but I'm not sure I see it yet.
Mr. Chair, let me try to answer that. I would hope that if you had Marty Brantley, he would tell you who on his staff has been involved in our STIP development. And again, he actually had two or three staff that were involved. For example, when we allocated the $500 million of money that was made available through OTIA 3, economic development, economic opportunity, and jobs creation was the buzzword there. And so you look at the projects that we've selected, and I'll get you folks a list of the projects. I don't know that you've looked at the draft statewide transportation improvement program. We met with them monthly to go over the projects. So we made sure that the projects we were selecting for inclusion as part of that $500 million worth of new modernization were projects that leveraged other economic opportunities throughout the rest of the state.
So in the STIP, are there projects that will match up with the department, economic development department's plans for their shovel-ready sites in industrial parks?
Mr. Chair, if you remember right, the legislature at the last session, and let me confess, we are doing better now than we ever have as a result of the direction the legislature gave us last session. The Industrial Lands Initiative, which identified the key strategic industrial areas for the state of Oregon, if you look at our investments that we're putting in out of the OTIA package, many of those highway construction projects are a direct result of the need to provide access or additional capacity for those particular industrial sites.
Excellent.
So it is very integrated and very coordinated all the way through. And I hope if you had Marty here, you ask him that, he could tell you that, yeah, we were involved and we had many discussions about making sure what was needed, for example, in the deal with the Mill Creek industrial area, what do we need to do out in Boardman, the Port of Boardman, to provide transportation facilities for jobs in those areas. Those are exactly the conversations we had. So I think you'd be pleased with the connections that we have there.
That's right.
And I think as a result of the leadership of the legislature saying that's what we want you to do, too, also.
Well, I guess I'd share with you, I would hope that would continue because I'm absolutely convinced you're a key part of developing the state. And you need to be locked arm in arm in their efforts in trying to move our state forward in job creation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Moving on then, in looking at the page that talks about the performance measures, with that mission statement in mind, we're going to try to walk through the connections between that as a mission statement, the goals that come off of that and the outcomes that come out the other end, and hopefully in terms of accomplishing what you'd like to see us doing, as well as how those will tie to benchmarks and to the performance measurements that will follow. So if we look at this page first, one of the key goals coming out of the mission statement was to improve travel safety in Oregon. Those measures you see below there are performance measures that we've identified as being key measures for the department that we'll go through in more detail in a few moments. But it's a variety of measures from rail to highway, dealing with everything that relates to safety, both in terms of direct measures as well as customer satisfaction about transportation safety. The second goal coming out of the mission statement is moving people and goods efficiently, or in other words, the system movement being efficient. And it's got measures about travel delay, vehicle miles traveled, pavement condition, to talk about the condition of that system and how efficiently we're able to move our customers. The third goal relates to providing a transportation system that supports livability and economic prosperity or opportunity. And there we get at the job measures, the passage of fish passage on state culverts, the bike lanes, intercity passenger service, elements that relate to livability. And lastly, the customer service measure, which isn't explicitly stated in our mission statement, but is implied and clear and critical to us, and that's providing excellent customer service. And we target on a few here, but as we talk about later, we're planning on expanding our customer service measures pretty significantly into the biennium. So that's the connection between the mission statement, Mr. Chair, and goals and measures that we have identified. The next page, page 2, talks about the Oregon benchmarks and connects those into it. And just for a brief illustration of how that works, on the left side of the page are the Oregon benchmarks. We relate to 11, or in other words, Oregon Department of Transportation supports 11 benchmarks. And on the right side are the ODOT performance measures. And just quickly going through those, our construction job impact goes to support the increased rural jobs and net job growth benchmarks, the fatalities, impaired driving, all the way down through derailment incidents support and hopefully reduce premature death and a benchmark there. Transit annual rides go towards independent seniors and disabled employment. The travel delay measure is its own benchmark and also is a performance measure at ODOT, as well as supporting alternatives to one-person commuting, which means getting people out of single-occupant vehicles and trying to educate and communicate with alternatives to traveling alone. The alternatives to one-person commuting also is supported by passenger rail ridership, which is a ODOT performance measure. Vehicle miles traveled is a benchmark, and we support that through the same kind of performance measure in the organization of vehicle miles traveled as well as passenger rail ridership. Road condition, we split it into two elements, pavement condition and bridge condition, and we made a request to the Progress Board to actually make that official, so we have a separate measure for each, and we have that, and we'll talk about that shortly. Air quality is supported by travel delay measure, or in other words, reducing congestion. And the last one is salmon recovery. That benchmark is supported and relates to our fish passage culvert measure. Chair, I'll move on unless there's questions. The next page ties them all together, the agency goals, outcomes, benchmarks, and performance measures, showing just as brief examples here on page 3. Improving safety is the goal. Outcomes such as reducing transportation-related crashes are the outcome we're trying to seek. Then that is supported by performance measures such as impaired driving or use of seat belts, and then finally the benchmarks that relate to that, such as premature death. So these couple pages tie together the prior pages and show how all four of them relate. And Mr. Chair, I could go through each one if you like.
Oh. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mike, could you describe the kind of relationship that the Oregon Progress Board has with ODOT, specific to, you know, is it something that you really incorporate into your daily activity, or is it something that sits on a shelf and you kind of meet some requirements and then go on about making roads safer and mobility better?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, as a department, we have in the past had a process where we review performance measurement on a quarterly basis. As we've gone through a lot of adjustment over this last year or so with the delivery of OTIA, we're changing some things about how we do that. We've moved up performance measurement to the Oregon Transportation Commission, and so we have what we call a dashboard of measures, which are just a handful, which go to the commission as the board of directors to make sure they're aware of what's critical for us. We have worked pretty closely with the progress board when we've talked about establishing or changing measures as part of this process. In terms of the benchmarks being the thing that we focus on, we actually try to focus more on our measures internally, which are then diagnostic of the benchmarks. So if the question is, have we worked on a daily basis to look at the benchmarks, I think the fair answer is not so much as how we look at our performance measurements about how they drive the benchmarks. So that's what we try to focus on, and yet keep the number of performance measures to a handful that can be reasonable for the agency. Does that answer your question, sir?
Thank you.
Follow up.
What's behind my question is the concept of measurements and goals appear to be pretty well embedded in all of these agencies, and it's become institutionalized. And I guess what's behind my goal or my question, and maybe this is more rhetorical than anything else, Mr. Chair, but has the Progress Board essentially outlived its purpose? And is it actually helpful in the process, or is it an appendage that's kind of riding along behind the process? And to what extent is it really practical in assisting these agencies to advance their mission? And that's a more rhetorical question, I think, to just at least put it on the table for discussion than to spend time now looking at it.
Senator Johnson?
And I guess I'd just trail along behind that in making the observation, and forgive me if I have bored some of you with this previously. I've said it a lot of times in a lot of venues since the session started. But some way to get some standardized best business practices embedded into each agency's performance measure so that we don't have this whole series of one-off performance measures that don't give us a way to track all agency performance over time. And what I'm thinking of is that each agency have, for example, how they're managing their cash, how they're managing their receivables and aging, if they are doing peer review on a nationally normed reference, to have those peer reviews included, some kind of standardized customer survey that asks the questions in the same year, in the same way, year over year, so that you can see patterns of performance develop. Some comment on how they're managing their legal fees, any audit results, so that the performance measures aren't so mysterious for all of us who are asked to deal with them. Each set of agency performance measures is different. Each set is a moving target each session. And how nice it would be to have some what I'm just calling best business practices embedded so that you can see performance one year over the next. And I don't level this as a criticism against ODOT so much as my frustration in dealing with performance measures that are unique to each agency and almost inscrutable, particularly as they change. You've got a whole page of them you want to modify, and you're not any different than any of the other agencies. If these are truly going to be a tool, having the Progress Board encourage agencies to make up new innovative sets for each agency, each biennia, it gets to a point of diminishing returns. So I will join my colleague in his rhetorical questions and statements about performance measures.
Representative Richardson.
I'd like to kind of continue that theme. And as I look at these, it's good to see the trends. That helps. You know, we can see, okay, it's getting better, it's getting worse. But it's solely focused on Oregon. And so for us to have any indication whether our fatality rate is good or totally unacceptable, it'd be nice to know where we stand in comparison to Washington, Idaho, California, and Nevada. And so I'm wondering if there are some standard performance measures that we could have that would, you know, show how we stand against other states that have similar considerations and concerns that we have.
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, I have the same interest. The department has the same interest. We have been working in those elements where we don't have connection to other states to try to get similarity of definitions. But fortunately, in the key measurement area that we're going to be looking at here, there are several where we do have national data. And as I go through, I'll point out some of those that we have readily available today. I'll also try to indicate to you those where you maybe have a possibility for the future of getting towards something that's a little bit more national in origin.
As you go through your performance measures, going up from or taking off on Representative Johnson, Senator Johnson's question, excuse me, the promotion. Is there any way of measuring the quality of the work performed?
Mr. Chair, I could go on that one for quite a while. Let me just take a minute to say, in response to Senator Johnson, who has a great idea, and
Mark that down. He said I had a
on the record.
I totally concur, and we have pushed this last year to get you that. And so right now, the Department of Administrative Services and five agencies have been working. I don't want to be redundant if other agencies have already mentioned this plan to have business measures for state as a whole. Has that come up in discussions to date? Okay. There are a series of agencies that have worked together to try to get at the very kind of measures the Senator is talking about, things like accounts payable costs, total cost to collect accounts receivable, the amount of people involved in those kind of business-related activities, time to recruit for positions, time to get a contract, all those kind of elements that relate to standard business practices. And we've identified five measures as the most critical ones for each one of these areas of finance, HR, information systems, procurement, customer satisfaction, and to say this is where we ought to go. We're at the point of just about releasing that to say this is where we think we should be, and the Department of Administrative Services is coordinating that final review and comparison for ODOT. We've already started on measuring against those that we think make sense, so we can have something that other agencies are doing the same measures, and when we come before our legislative committee, you can have something that says how long does it take you, or how many people per payroll person do you have in ODOT as compared to another agency. You'll be able to see a statistic that hopefully has some good source data for you.
How do you measure good work from sloppy work on a road project? When I build a building in my little business, the finish work is one of those areas where I can tell how much detail was put into the project. And then I look at change orders, and I'm able to look at the number of change orders and the type of change orders to determine if the planning up front was sufficient. Is there any way for you to provide information on how you measure the quality of the real work that you're focused on?
Yes. Mr. Chair, let me start and just hit a few things that come to mind. The first is we have criteria in many areas that say here are our standards and here's how we should do a project. We have an internal audit function that can come in and do a review to say for these kind of projects, these are your standards, here's what you actually did. So we can get feedback to say things worked out well, you did a good job, you did what you were supposed to do according to your standards. On the other hand, we also have information about just through a performance audit that can identify here are some things that worked out well or didn't work out well, even if there aren't standards that were established. So those are a couple of things. The other is looking comparison against other states.
Right, like just really quick on that, though. And then does the state of Oregon protect itself through the contract process in terms of making sure the quality of work is acceptable, and if not, we have a mechanism to protect the state?
Yes, if you're talking about within a contract, we write in the protections to make sure that we've got the state of Oregon protected. I have to admit, though, we're doing some major changes as we do more of our work through contracting. And maybe I'm just going to say that as we make those changes, we're making sure that there are appropriate incentives and disincentives so that the contractor understands the need to live within these kind of parameters.
Mr. Chair, and if I could follow on that very quickly, obviously when we do construction work, which is the most visible thing you see out there, we have very strict construction specifications for the type of rock, the compaction of that rock, the concrete, what strength it needs to meet. All of that needs to be met or we don't pay the contractor. And we do, every time when we're done with the project, we do a quality check, usually a walkthrough with the contractor, because frankly we want to know who are the good contractors, who are the bad contractors, and where may be some of the problems.
If there is a problem out there, then, you know, it could be a design problem, it could be a construction problem. We usually know those pretty quickly if there's a problem. And we usually try to figure out what the cause of that is. And obviously, that's why contractors have performance bonds and insurance to be able to deal with those kind of issues if it's their problem. If it's ours, we're self-insured. If it's on a private consultant, there's errors and omission insurance to deal with some of those particular issues. I might add that our commission is actually pushing us to be more aggressive in terms of quality assurance, quality control, because I think of one paving job that is a chip seal job that's come loose in the Burns area, that we need to determine what went wrong with that particular job. And they're very interested in again, the responsibility and how we assure that the Oregonians are getting the quality that they expect out of that work. But quality is a consideration in everything we do. And before I forget it, I should point out in the back of the room, the chair of our commission, Stuart Foster, just walked in. I think he'd probably say the same thing on that. So okay. I'm sorry, I cut off Representative Burley there.
On this discussion we just held, is there a way to quantify that to be able to show this committee where those areas of improvement need to occur?
There are some areas, Mr. Chair, whether it's a number of change orders, whether it's any one of a number of kind of measures that can show how we do compared to how other states do. We have various audits that have pointed that out. We have a couple active audits going on right now, but if there's a particular question that the chair would like to have us come back with some information on, we can certainly either pull those audits and get that information to you or do something that might be more future focused to get you an answer in the future.
Well, I don't want to create unnecessary work. Your folks are already working pretty hard. I just want to figure out how do we quantify quality work. And so why don't we have a discussion on that in the future?
Okay.
That is an issue I'd like to have us
be happy to do that, Mr. Chair.
Representative Burley, and then.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Performance measures are, I mean, they're very difficult, obviously. Cause and effect, how do you measure these things? I absolutely concur with Senator Johnson on the business measures. But aside from the brick-and-mortar aspect of your enterprise, I'm looking, for example, at the safety program, and about $57 million, 5.7 of which is on the 10% cut list. And I look at page 7, key performance measures, safe drivers. Measure-related highlights, percentage of drivers who have not had a ticket or crash in the prior 3 years. So that then becomes the definition of a safe driver. Two bullets down, it says, this is a measure of DMV programs only. How do we know that? How can you show that? How can you tell me that for every $1 million we put into the highway safety program, we're going to reduce the number or increase the number of safe drivers? What is the cause and effect directly? How can we show that? That's the question for me as I'm sitting here looking, should we cut $10 million out of the safety program? What are we going to lose?
Mr. Chair and Representative Burley, the reason we're focusing that this way is we're not going in and making connections to other elements of the safety program. We're tying into the DMV records and to the fact that we've got people coming in and getting their licenses, and we've got a DMV record process that shows where people are in terms of their accident record. And that's why it's tying into this. It's not trying to equate that there are other pieces that have caused this to occur. But you're right, one of the challenges in terms of safety in general is, did the fact that a person drove safe relate to engineering? Did it relate to education? Did it relate to enforcement? Did it relate to emergency services getting the person out so there wasn't a fatality when it might have been? All those are critical pieces, and we have to admit that performance measurement is always a work in progress about trying to determine who ought to be showing responsibility. But the bottom line is if we don't come in and measure it and at least have the information, we wouldn't know. So rather than saying that it's credit or detriment to DMV, it's simply saying it's keys off of the DMV record process. And the fact that they do the tests for people to get license and they do the records about when a person has an accident.
Yeah, and
please follow up.
Thank you. And I don't mean to be criticizing. I mean, it's probably just as much rhetorical as Senator Morse's comment. This is a ubiquitous problem that we have, and I think if we're just all very attentive as we define these measures, trying to figure out how can we link the dollars to the outcome, it would be more productive.
Mr. Chair and Representative Burley, we totally agree. I think measurement is critically important to doing the kind of service that you want us to do, but making that tie between budgets and measures are sometimes a very difficult tie to make. The request this session was to try to make some connections between those. That's going to be a tangential one for us this first time through, but as we get more experience with it, we hope to be able to have better ties for the future.
Thank you.
Representative Boone.
Yeah, I'm tending to agree with Representative Burley, and looking over these transportation fatalities, you've got speeding and or driving too fast for the conditions has now surpassed drinking and driving as the number one cause of fatal driver error. And I believe that. Mm-hmm. Down here in the next impaired driving section, you have traffic fatalities due to impairment from drugs other than alcohol are not factored into this measure, and there's only 24 fatalities out of a total 208 due to drug-only impairment. How is this, and I don't know what year this is, but how is this going to factor in the meth problem because of its rapidly increasing incidence? And we're seeing it more on the road in crashes. It's not all alcohol, and a lot more of it is speeding, but there's a whole lot of meth activity out there, and you don't know how high they are or what, but that's not even figured in here. So how is that going to, if we reduce this, I guess my point is if we reduce money towards safety programs, which I would hope would include education about these things, how's that going to help us with our meth problem?
Mr. Chair, Representative Boone, we understand it's not going to help if we make a reduction there. What has occurred right now is that the safety program does what's called a performance plan, and copies of these can be given to the committee if you wish. But what they do each year, per requirements from the federal government, along with the federal funds they receive, is to set out the major problems. And like we talked about before, the speed issue has surpassed on a national basis. But we have particular problems in Oregon, like methamphetamine use. And this plan addresses those elements that get at what we're trying to do in Oregon to have the best possible impact on fatalities, accidents, and other issues around things like seatbelt use. Mm-hmm. So this plan is the way of trying to get at that sort of thing. But certainly it isn't our goal to be able to say that there's a major reduction that ought to occur within safety. We're just trying to show that here's the performance, here's what we do to try to contribute towards it.
Why don't we do this? Why don't we have you just start at the beginning? We'll go through each one rather than having you jump around.
Pick them all, okay.
Yeah.
So, Mr. Chair, if everybody's kind of got the flow okay of the goals, outcomes, benchmarks, performance measurement connection that occurred on page 3 or 4, I'll just start through the measures. And we've already talked about number one, which is on page 5, dealing with transportation fatalities. And just to go through one time sort of the flow of how these documents look, they'll have the title up in the left-hand corner. This one's number one, and talking about the measure and how it's addressed. In this case, traffic fatalities per 100 million vehicle miles traveled. And then we have a listing of values. Some of these have been done for some time and will show a few years of values. Others are more recently done. You won't have as much background information about the value, meaning the actual result. The targets are an indication of what the target was or will be. Now we're into the future. In this case, for instance, looking at 2004 of 1.36 fatalities per 100 million vehicle miles traveled. And then on the chart on the right, these first few are particularly complex because we've been asked to make sure that we include it into the chart, not just the rate of that particular measure, in this case, fatality rate, but also the targets, which are shown on the right. And you can see the targets going down between years 04 and 07. And then also state troopers as an indication just of how things relate. The triangle component, tied together triangles towards the top, show the number of state troopers now or projected into the near-term future. And it shows how they are going down significantly into the 04 period.
Yeah, quite a reaction there.
Okay. Sorry, Senator. Then if you look down below, the measure-related highlights, each time there'll be some brief comments about the situation on the measure, whether things are going up, down, or if there's some particular relationship to the budget that we can highlight. So on this one, as an example, Mr. Chair, we're indicating that the funding is at a continued level. We're not showing major increases or reductions in the direct areas that relate to this topic. We are indicating that the goal is to reduce fatalities on state highways by a lot of activities that we've talked about already, those four E's that we keep discussing, which I think the committee probably understands, and to make sure that we're working on each one of those as a group within ODOT, not just viewing ourselves as separate elements of the department, but working on design issues, working on safety projects that may have an ability to deal with increased safety on the roadway, and then things we manage in terms of educational and enforcement, both for the education coming out of our Transportation Safety Division as well as the enforcement, where we do actually make payment to the Department of State Police for certain kinds of focused enforcement.
I'm going to interrupt you really quick. Susie has a...
Mike, I think that it would be more useful to the committee if you started on page 47 and used the format that is in that section. It's the key measure analysis because it provides a couple of... it's the same information, only presented in a little bit different format, but it also has you compare the actual performance to the target. It shows the target data, which those other forms don't, and it has some information about the national comparisons that other formats don't have. So
happy to go through. These have more data, and what we understood was that the key measures were supposed to be on a shorter format, but we're happy to go through the more detail if you'd like.
This is the one the co-chairs like to focus on.
Okay. We can do that. And if you look at Measure 1 and the information coming off of that, I've highlighted most of what's in there. The one thing that I think would be useful to additionally indicate is when we have information about national data, we'll state that here. If I don't have it here, but I know that it's available, I'll make sure we get that back and talk with Troy Costellas so that when you come into phase two, when there's national data, we can get that to you. For instance, on the Oregon fatality rate, it's 1.46 per 100 million vehicle miles traveled in 2003. The late-breaking 2004 information is 1.25. So if you wish to add to your charts the 2004 data for the transportation fatalities piece, just was received, and it's 1.25 instead of 1.46.
Really quick, share with us how come we're not able to get the target data for the previous year so we can measure actual versus target?
Mr. Chair, the process of working with the Progress Board and Department of Administrative Services said that when we first established the concept of key performance measures, when it first went out, it says you do not have to establish targets. Now, for our own internal programs, we do have targets that existed that we have established with the federal government and would be happy to share those with you for past periods.
But this, just so I'm clear, though, this isn't a new...
Correct. We have our own internal targets, but for the key performance program, they didn't actually have targets that related to it until 2004, because that's when the key performance measures idea came to us.
Thank you.
Okay. So anytime that you'd like to have historical data for the longer-lasting measures, like these ones that relate to national measures of accidents and fatalities, we can get that for you. So I wanted to make sure it was clear, though, that when we talk about this this rate, the 1.25 rate, is below the national average, which is 1.48. We had a question earlier about what the national average might be for some of these. The national average for transportation fatalities is 1.48. If there are other questions about the fatalities measure, I'd be happy to get into it, but that's a quick hit about that. And we go on to the transportation injuries, unless there are other questions.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
How do you correlate some of your data against things that are external to your ability to control? I'm looking for that piece that links up many fewer troopers there are.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, wondering how we can correlate the fact that troopers are going down and yet we also are projecting and hoping to see the number of fatalities go down. And that seems out of sync. That's what the Senator's getting at.
Yeah.
Yes. We understand, and that's why those four E's are such a complex element. Whether the enforcement piece takes a while to actually have an impact, whether the education component and the fact that we're, as we'll find out in a few minutes, doing very well nationally on the number of people wearing seatbelts. Our emergency responses are doing relatively well. The fact that we've got good education pieces going out there and are winning awards for those educational pieces on both radio and TV and other components. what are the relationships between those? I don't have a great answer for you. I think maybe Troy Casales can probably try to weave that in the best way possible for you.
Senator Morris.
Mr. Chair, I think I have the answer. It's the Coburg speed trap on I-5.
There you go. I knew there was an answer here.
Yes. Explains it.
We've solved the problem. Senator Westland. Well, not to put words in your mouth, sir, but what Senator Johnson just heard you say is that if you reduce the number of state troopers, the serious injury, accident, and fatality will go down on our state highways. It's proof. It's right here.
Mr. Chair, let the record show that that's not what was stated.
The good news is I don't have to worry about all those bike guys calling me because other people are going to call me.
I'm just interpreting your brainwaves.
Mr. Chair, if I could just interject on this, too. First off, I'm just really pleased that you folks are engaged in this in this level because we are attempting to understand the cause and effect of the work we do and how it relates to the overall reduction of fatalities. I mean, that's our desire here. I think you're going to find out when you look at the performance measures or have an opportunity to talk with, like, Greg Del Ponte from our motor carrier transportation safety standpoint, you'll find out that he has done a marvelous job of using the data in a way of how he's actually deploys his resources to assure that we're getting it. And I think that's what you want in everything we do. And we're starting to find those connections. But in terms of understanding all of the variables involved, it is difficult. But I know that's exactly where you want to go. And I want you to understand that is where the department wants to go, too, for those areas that are under our control.
Right. Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, Director, just in line with what you're saying and with what Senator Johnson has said, if it was to be something within your responsibility. I mean, you're responding to traffic collisions and crashes, much of which is caused by things beyond your control. If there was a bench measure, and I'm not recommending that there is, that said how many are caused because of the condition of the road. You know, you got a drop-off on the shoulder, or you've got too steep, or you know that kind of thing, then the fatality figures would actually relate to your job performance in ODOT, but you're being asked to just give standardized information which we really can't directly attribute to the job that you're doing, other than if it looks good, you take credit, and if it doesn't, then blame it on enforcement. Anyway, some of these are more related specifically to ODOT, and some are just general traffic issues that have been placed in under your umbrella here.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, I agree with you. I would encourage you to look like when we get to the for example, we monitor truck at fault. Where are the trucks at fault at accident in terms of the accidents we're dealing with? And we've done some things to attack that with our motor carrier programs, for example, that has reduced the truck at fault accidents, which then reduces fatalities and injuries. And so those are the kind of things I'm talking about we can do. But you're right. We have to understand the cause and effect and the thing that we're measuring, how it relates back to that ultimate measure of fatalities. And we're trying to do that. And I think we're getting better.
Representative Boone.
I have waited for a long time to be able to say this. And now I finally have a voice to say it. Every fatal crash I've responded to as a firefighter since 1991 when I joined the fire department has been caused by stupid driving, alcohol, drugs, driving too fast. You know, you can go all through that. Not one has been due to a problem with the highway. There is no big pits in the middle that someone hits in the middle of the, you know. Some have been elk in the way, things like that, but not one has been the fault of the road. And when I heard people say all those years you need to widen Highway 26 and up the speed to 80 miles an hour so people can get to the beach faster, I'm here to tell you folks that's not the way it is. And I agree with the speed thing, and then right behind it or equal with it is stupid driving. Bad choices. People on the ice with four-wheel drives think they can go 80 miles an hour, and they do it. They try. So anyway, thank you very much.
Stupid driving endemic to residents of your district?
You know, most of them are from out of the district. Those are all medical emergencies.
Oh my gosh. Mr. Chair, I think it was masterful, but anyway. I'll...
Why don't we try and, to help us get moving a little bit, could we just take about 2 minutes each one of these? And
okay. Mr. Chair, we'll try to do a couple minutes for each, and just let me know if you have questions.
Yeah.
Moving on to the second one, which is transportation injuries, which is on page 6 of the summary and on page 49 on the detail. That one is traffic injuries per 100 million vehicle miles traveled. We have a new 04 number there also, which has gone down slightly from 03. Let me state what that is. It's not on your sheet. That number is 73. So the new number is 73. The 2003 number was 74. Traffic injuries per 100 million vehicle miles traveled. We are below the targets, so it's looking good there. In terms of the issues that go on there, major injuries account for only 6% of all injuries, which means that in terms of Representative Richardson's comment earlier, as we try to pick apart a measure and determine what's happening good or bad within that measure, that can give us good information about what we're doing to try to reduce the level of injury even when there is one. So that means things like seat belts can help reduce the injuries, and we're getting across a good message on use of seat belts as shown by that measure. The next one is safe drivers, number 3. And again, this is on page 7 and on 51 of the detail. And this is a percentage of licensed drivers who drove safely during the prior 3 years. We talked about it briefly a few minutes ago. The new information there that came in completing the calendar 04 is 64.1. So in 2003, it was 62.3. The new data is 64.1. And what that shows is that we're are at a level where we're getting performance beyond the target at this point, and that's looking very good. And this is a relatively new measure for us, which is trying to help identify when we're doing a good job of keeping people through the different 4 E's, driving safely. And again, as mentioned earlier, the target is for every 3 years of having 3 years of driving without accidents and tickets. That's what we're trying to key there as the definition. The next one is impaired driving, which is talking about percent of traffic fatalities that involve alcohol. The new 04 measure is not available yet, so we do not have the latest information. Some of these measures are driven off of national databases that take a little bit to get. We expect to have that measure in May. As mentioned by, I believe it was Representative Boone, traffic fatalities due to impairment from drugs other than alcohol are not included in this particular measure, but we do have information on that if the members would like to receive that. On to safety belts. Safety belts have been proven to be a key element in terms of accidents and death, and as the members know, are required in Oregon now. Most states do require it, but still we've done very well in getting the percentage of our citizens who are using them. As you can see, for 2004, the value was 94% are using safety belts. The target is 95. If we actually achieve the 95% level, we would be the top state in the nation as well as the top entity in the world in terms of safety belt use. Right now, I think we're fourth in the nation with the 94% level, and just going up that 1% would put us at the top.
So what do we need to do to get that 1%?
Mr. Chair, one of the things we've got to work on is males using safety belts. Males don't use them as much as females, especially males of the younger age. So we're trying to get that communicated out to people so that they can understand the problems of when
how
you
do
use
do
the safety. Pardon me.
How do we do that? How do we get the 1%?
Well, one of those is educating in high schools where you're out showing the impact of not wearing a safety belt. We have films and actually have static displays that have been taken out to high schools and elsewhere to show them what it looks like, a car with a person that did not survive because they did not wear a safety belt, and a similar car where a person did wear a safety belt and survived. So giving that perspective of the reality of it. So it's targeting those by using the statistics of who's not using, who's using, and then trying to target those markets, just like one would do in branding in the private sector. That's what they're trying to do.
Well, knowing how close you are to that recognition, I would assume that's something we ought to be trying to reach.
Absolutely.
Mr. Chair, I think, again, look at all the E's. You need education, which we just talked about. You need enforcement. You need click it or ticket. You know, you need to do some stings out there to get people to understand that we're serious about that. Mm-hmm. And you just need to, again, inculcated into everything we do, and pretty soon your children will not let you get in a car unless you're buckled in. So I mean that's our goal, and I think we're making progress there.
Well, when we come back to round two, I would hope I'd like to have this noted. I'd like a strategy to get that 1%.
We'll have that, Mr. Chair. The next one is large truck accidents, number six, just showing the number of truck at fault accidents. And again, this one has a 2003 measure of 585 accidents that were at fault accidents by trucks. A little bit up from the 02 value. We do not have the 04 information yet. We expect that in a couple months. One of the reasons for the value going up and having more accidents in 03 was the ice and snow that was a little stronger at the end of the calendar year 03 than we normally have. So that's where we expect a lot of the reasons for that occurring. There are no questions. We'll move on, Mr. Chair, to rail crossing incidents, number seven. This one has a new value. We had the 2003 at 26. 04 just came in, and it's 22. So we've gone down on the highway railroad at-grade incidents for 04, and actually down below now the target that existed for going into the short-term future. We find in looking at the national data on this one that we are in the top 20 states in this regard, so not as high as safety belts, but at least doing better than average in that regard. And we've got a major focus of our program to make sure we continue improving in this area. Derailment incidents, unfortunately we had one just recently in Salem a couple days ago, but overall you can see that there's been a drop in the number of derailment incidents as it went from 1998 actually an increase in the number in the last few years from 25 to 40. And as we look at this, the data as it's racking up 404, we don't have the newest information available yet, but there's been a lot of shifting of investigation resources from the federal government who's responsible for derailment investigations and safety investigations onto other projects this last year. And so we're a little concerned about that movement of resources away from Oregon, and feel like there is some impact that's occurred in terms of the derailments in Oregon because of that. We've also had some turnover on our own staff and are focusing with a new rail administrator to make sure we get folks hired who have the certifications and get trained up as quickly as possible so we can do the safety inspections on the front end to keep these from happening.
Let's take a quick question from Representative Richardson, then we'll go to Senator Moore.
Mr. Chair, directors, I have concerns about questions about the setting of targets. I mean, the goal of targets is something to shoot for. And I look through many of these, and I see that the targets are higher than where we already are or where we've been in the past, which doesn't really lead to a lot of, you know, increased desire for performance if you're shooting to merely maintain what you've got because you're already doing better than the targets. So who sets the targets, and why are not targets adjusted to a reasonably achievable improvement rather than just left at a rate that's higher than where we're already at?
Yeah. Mr. Chair and Representative Richardson, your definition of where a target should be is correct. If you look at the derailment incidents, we've got a target of 42, and that was set in the 2002 timeframe. It would have been a slight reduction. With the achievement of 40 in our most recent information, it's something we do need to be looking at.
Well, take a look at from 1998 to 2003. It looks like you're working toward the target.
Fewer cops.
From 2002 through 2003, you're saying?
No, from 98.
Way back in time, I'm sure there would have been a different target at that time frame.
I'm saying it was 25 then, it's 40 in 03, and then target's 42, so keep working, and pretty soon we can meet our target. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's my point.
Yeah. Your definition is exactly right. The challenge is that the last couple of years have been relatively high. This year we expect to be significantly over the target. And that's why we're wanting to try to make sure we do those things, working with the federal government to get our performance down. We're expecting it's probably going to be more in the neighborhood of 50 this year.
Can you share with the committee what those steps would be to reduce
perfect segue.
The human error? I assume some of those folks who perhaps could be causing these situations aren't even Oregonians.
Well, two things, Mr. Chair. First, some of the detail about this would probably just as well to hit at phase two when we talk about the detail of the budget. But on the other hand, we are working, like I mentioned earlier, because of the impact of the investigators that work for the federal government to make sure we get that shift to occur to bring them back and focus here instead of the special projects that we're working on outside of the investigations for Oregon. So that's one piece. The other is that our new rail administrator is focusing on a major program to make sure that we're dealing with derailment and education and communication around that.
Is the education supported with federal dollars? Help me here. I need a little 101. I'm envisioning a UP train heading down I-84 there. I'm envisioning interstate activity, and I'm trying to figure out if we're providing the education, are we providing it not only for Oregon but also for Washington, Idaho, Montana, or is there a federal component to this where they help share the cost so all states benefit?
Two things on that. The federal government is responsible for the investigation component, and they do investigation for the incident after the fact. In terms of safety inspections, we do safety inspections on the front end for the prevention work.
What about the education?
And the education components are, I believe, a shared expense. In other words, I think we can use some of the federal money for that, but it's mainly state. It's mainly state responsibility. We get payments made by the firms themselves, by the railroads, who pay for our inspectors to inspect them. And then we work with them on trying to make sure the information gets out to educate both them as well as the public. So you may have heard of some of our public campaign programs at the state fair, county fairs, that talk about crossing safety, that talk about things that relate more to the direct public, like crossing incidents, not so much the derailment incidents, but gets at both.
Okay.
And I guess, Mr. Chair, I would add that I think if Kelly was here, she would tell you that the derailments are probably a pretty good surrogate for the condition of the tracks. In other words, what you're seeing here, and I think this is what Representative Richardson is frustrated about, is that if you look at what's happening over time, it actually looks like the derailments are going up. And it's, and in some ways you can see that because the condition of the track, especially on the short lines and on many of the class ones, is going down. And so, again, that's why we inspect the track and make sure that the speeds are appropriate for the sections of track, because as those tracks degrade and they start to move and the bays and the ballast start to move, you start to have derailments. So this also relates back to the investment in the rail, and one of the things we're trying to do, and this is my plug for the Connect Oregon, is to essentially provide resources to help, you know, make sure that those tracks are in good condition, because they're not only good for the standpoint of carrying better and heavier rail cars, they're also better from the standpoint of safety for derailments. And so if the system, we know the system is getting older and degrading and getting worse, it's hard to have a target that goes down when you're fighting the realities of the track condition. So I just wanted to point out what's going on there.
And thank you. I want to stop right here and ask Director Warner if you want to have your chairman, Chair Foster, if he had any comments that he wanted to share with us. I'd be remiss if we didn't at least provide the opportunity.
And I want him to know I didn't do this.
To bring him up and to share his thoughts with us. It's terrific having you here this afternoon.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I actually had about an hour here, and I thought, you know, I need to come in and watch this process, and these performance standards are critical to the commission as well as to you. I think the Director Warner talked about the issues and what our expectations are, which are similar to the legislature's expectations, and agree that we can always, you know, our expectations ought to be going up, and we ought to work for excellence, and we continually talk about the excellence in what we provide. Some of the things we don't have control over, you've just been talking about one that's frustrating. We don't have control over whether the railroads put investments back into their trackage, and that goes way beyond just derailments. That goes to the Oregon economy, which is really dependent upon that portion of the private sector providing adequate service to our companies that are dependent on it. So anyway, I found this to be most interesting this afternoon, and appreciate being able to sit in and listen to it.
Well, we truly appreciate you coming, and I want to say on behalf of our committee, and I have the Senate chair and the House chair here, how much we appreciate your service to the commission and the many hours and miles you put on your vehicle to participate in I want you to know you've got a pretty darn good director here and a pretty good deputy director there leading this process, and we appreciate all the work that they do.
Thank you very much.
So thank you very much. I think what we're going to do, committee, is we're going to stop at this time, and we'll finish with our work tomorrow if we can. I don't know if Chair Gilman or, in this case, Chair Verger, if you have anything you want to add.
No, I'm just fine. We're moving along just fine. I probably will give our esteemed guest the heads up that when you get to that jobs part on your job performance, I'll probably like to grill you. So that's okay. Just a heads up.
Well, we have two more days. We're going to have Thursday and then Monday, and hopefully we'll be completely wrapped up on Monday. If we have any additional time on Monday, that'll probably be a good time for a little question and answer and a chance for us to air any questions that we would want to air. So with that, I think we will adjourn for the day. Thank you. Can I get some